This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. I am so honored and thrilled to welcome to Joy on Paper someone who I've been looking forward to. I've had the book for quite a while. And so, you know, I always get these books ahead of time. And I have been enjoying it so much. Stephen Kent Mirisu has written a book that is so wonderful. And it has just been keeping me busy for actually a couple of months now. Lineage. It's called The Life and Love and Six Generations in California Wine. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Patsy. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it is a thrill because, I like wine, but that's not so much why I was thrilled about this book. I think it's just so beautifully written. And I have to tell people that we're talking to someone who was born to write, because you are a really fantastic author. But also born eventually after a few, you know, side tracks, you were born to make wine.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for the kind words. I really appreciate that. Yes, my family is the oldest winemaking family in the country. I'm the sixth generation of the family in the business, winemaker. My son now is the seventh generation. So I always kind of love this little factoid. Puts a little bit of a context around how long my family's been doing this. 6 years before Abraham Lincoln was president, my family was making wine in San Jose, California. So we've been doing this for 167 years or something like that. I'm an English major, not a math major.
So 1854.
1854. Yeah.
Which
it's been a long time.
It's also the year that Sherlock Holmes was born. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Fascinating. I love that.
So, okay. Well, this book, it is as much about your, just this true grit, real, you know, a family that has persistence and has gone through so much. And through all these years and all this time, you've come out a real winner with your brand of wine, Stephen Kent. And it is, I think it's just such an uplifting book. It's such an inspirational book. You know, memoirs, people, you know, write their memoirs. And this is more than a memoir, because this is also, in a way, a novel. Just like, it's a hard-to-believe novel, you know. It's, but it's really great.
Thank you. I when I first started writing this book, I've been writing my whole life. And I have a master's in literature from NYU, and my goal when I was 22 or 23 was to teach college literature and write books, and that it didn't happen exactly that way. I left the family winery when I was 17 to go to college on the East Coast. Didn't think I'd ever get back in the wine business, but things happen in life for everybody, and you take different turns. Circumstances kind of force you in certain directions, or you get to choose different alternative paths as you live longer. And paths brought me back to California with my wife and 2.5 kids at the time in the early 90s, and I had an opportunity to kind of forge a way back into the family business in the mid-90s, and that's when my father and I started the Stephen Kent Winery.
Well, it is a fascinating story. Now, as someone who spent 6 months picking grapes, and it is hard work. I so loved it, because as I was picking the grapes, I did think about where they were going, because I was in Israel, and I worked for 6 months. sort of, they gave me the locals didn't really want to pick grapes, I'll tell you.
Sure.
So the Americans arrive, and they, for the first job they wanted to give us was pick the grapes, you know?
Right.
So
right.
So I spent 6 months picking the grapes. And actually, I found it very, it really opened my mind to so many things. Because as you're picking grapes, you have time to think. And I knew where the grapes were going because they were going, you know, to make Israeli wine. And for me, I was thinking, as I'm picking these grapes, I'm thinking, you know, somebody's going to be drinking this wine on Shabbat. Somebody's going to be saying L'chaim with this wine. And I was always thrilled. Now, I will admit, the other volunteers, we were volunteers, and the other volunteers had none of this kind of inspiration to keep them going because they really complained nonstop about picking grapes. It's hard work.
Right.
It is hard work.
Extremely hard work. The workers who help us are really the unsung heroes of winemaking. Winemaking itself is a physically difficult job. It's intellectually compelling as a winemaker when you're putting blends together and the like, which I get the opportunity to do. But there's a great deal of physical labor that's involved in taking something that, you know, sort of transforming or helping to shepherd unruly nature into a beautiful bottle of wine, which really for me is a sort of the physical manifestation of a winemaking philosophy, of a kind of aesthetic consideration of life, which I think wine fits into in so many different ways. But it all starts with stooped back, you know, getting down to where the grapes are growing and cutting and filling bins up and then pressing and crushing and the whole bit. So it's wine is a seemingly romantic thing, and it is romantic in a lot of ways. The processing of it is like processing any other agricultural crop, but what wine gives you afterward is something that no other crop can give you. It's linked to culture and history and religion and its ability to transfigure and transform time, to create and strengthen personal relationships, to go great with food, to just be delicious, is something that there's no other product in the world does that. And no other product in the world has 8,000 years of history behind it as well. So wine and what I was trying to capture in the book, and hopefully I did, was giving people an unvarnished view of what the production side of wine is like, but also to link that with the many, many generations of my own family in the business, but a link between me and every other winemaker who has come before me and who will come after me. It's a brotherhood, a sisterhood of sorts. Everyone who devotes his or her life to working with nature to try to create something beautiful does it for reasons beyond fame and beyond money, because there's very little of that in this business. But we do it because ultimately we want to take care of people. Wine, like restaurants, is a hospitality business at the very core. We take care of people. We are hospitable. We're sort of a hospital in a way for helping to alleviate daily care to the extent that we can. And when we can do it in a way that, and with a product, a beverage that allows you to kind of put special sort of personal pins in your own timeline. People are often buying vintages from the years that their kids were born. You celebrate people's successes and the passing of loved ones with a glass of wine. It's a very intimate and a very profoundly deep relationship, I think, that you can create with wine if you're of that type of person. And that's what I was hoping to accomplish with the book.
Well, you did, and you accomplished a lot more. For me, of course, wine, when you're used to having wine every Shabbat, every night, you know, every Shabbat,
right.
It is something that you're connected to. Of course, it's a different kind of wine so often, but it is, in essence, exactly this, the connection through the ages. And I was fascinated. So you went off. I was from a farm in northern Michigan, and I had the same thing. I had to get away from the farm. My brother did too. We had to get away from the farm and head for New York, or in my case, I headed for England. And but it's funny, my brother landed up going back to the farm and becoming an organic farmer. You know,
wow.
Which is
fantastic.
Which, yeah, you know, and this. There are these roots that take us back sometimes to these parts of our life that are so important. And I loved when you talk about your father. Now, why I say that this is more than a book about wine and that you are a born writer is when it's just one little sentence and you're talking about how your father, you know, sells his share in the business, and you can go into that if you want. But you talk about he gets together. The minute I read this, I thought, oh my goodness, I've got a real writer here. I can't even say. So you tell us about who got your father back into the wine business.
Well,
the hirsute Hungarian.
Yes. So my father worked with a gentleman named Ivan Fusey, Ivan Tomas Fusey. He was always called Ivan. And he was a wine broker and actually worked for my father at Mirasu, the family winery, for a while. They were friends. Ivan always wanted his own wine brand. And my father had, when he sold his share in Mirasu Vineyards back to the family, he was not going to immediately jump back into the business. But because they were friends and because my dad knew certain things about the business that Ivan didn't, they started this new wine company. And Ivan was one of these, like, 5'4", gigantic personality, eyebrows out, you know, seemingly twice the width of his head. He was a long, full beard. So he was an amazing personality, very romantic, and they were able to make a really nice brand with Ivan Tomas until Ivan passed in 1997.
Well, I thought that was the way you describe him. It was so. This is so writerly, you know. It's just perfect. You set the tone. You set the character. You make us really get just in that little bit that you write about him. It's so great. And I will say this: as I read the book, and I'll tell you the part I got to eventually, the part in the kitchen where you're making you're peeling potatoes. All through the book, I kept having these images of you. Now that you've discovered this absolute joy of writing, you know, seeing your words published, that you're going to eventually write a wonderful novel. I know it. It's going to be some kind of international, best-selling novel that's got the wine business in it somewhere. I don't know if you have the book already written and in a drawer, but you're definitely going to be writing something else besides this book.
Well, from your lips to God's ears. Thank you very much. One of the things that was the most important realization for me during this process, and I started out, as kind of mentioned earlier, sort of scribbling my entire life. There'd be certain things walking around a vineyard, I'd notice something I thought would be kind of neat to put down on paper. So in 2018 or early 19, I had about 15,000 words, disconnected thoughts. It had no structure. There was a fair amount written about the family history, and I shared it with my father, who, unbeknownst to me, sent it to a friend who sent it to my eventual publisher. And I got an email kind of out of the blue that said, if you ever finish this thing, I'd love to publish it. Now, this is 30 years, 35 years after my graduate school experience, and where I, you know, because of kids and because of wanting to move on in my life, I got back in the family business and overjoyed to have done that. But I never thought that this would happen. And so what I realized throughout the experience was, this is something that I cannot help but do, continue to write. I write, you know, daily for business-related purposes, but I also write daily for the next project. And I do have a novel in mind.
I knew it. You see, people can never fool me. When I find a writer, I find a writer. And I know it's going to, there's so many things that, and always with a little bit of the wine business in it. It's fantastic. It's going to be a great, great book.
I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be sort of a Don DeLillo-esque My thought process is trying to capture what California means in novel form.
You're going to do it. I know it.
Down the road, ways.
I know you're going. It's going to be a success, and it's going to be a best-selling novel because you have a natural talent, a wonderful voice. You know, authors are always looking for a voice. And then you come along and like, what? You have that voice. So we're looking forward to that. But I, you know, because this is a show where a lot of authors are listening and they're saying, you know, I love to write, but boy, you know, it's so difficult. You have to get out there and sell. Well, you have experience too in that. So that's going to really help you when you finally write your novel. Because talk about the marketing. I found it so funny that you went out to market and you tell a shop owner, I'm only going to give you 12 bottles.
Right. I
laughed my head off because I've done so much marketing in my life. And when I read that, I thought, oh, this guy is, I mean, you're so cute. It's adorable. As a matter of fact, I have to add, I love, before I forget, I love the photo of you sort of kissing a
bottle of Cab Franc, yeah.
I love it. It's so beautiful. I thought that was so cool. But tell us, why would you tell a customer, oh, I'm only going to give you 12 bottles?
Well, I was a schmo.
No.
Very inexperienced in the wine business. And we make wine predominantly from an area called the Livermore Valley, which is one of the oldest wine growing areas in California, and I think one of the best for Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc, the kind of grapes that Napa Valley specializes in. And you can only have one predominant wine region, one of the, you know, quote-unquote best wine region, and Napa has held that mantle and probably will forever. So my whole career has been a Sisyphean task of pushing this Livermore Valley rock up a hill and charging a lot of money, comparatively, for wines from Livermore that I have great faith and belief in terms of their overall quality, especially compared to Napa Valley wines. And the idea of allocations at that time and restricting the amount of wine that any one person could get was predominant in the business at that time. And I felt like, hey, our wine is really good. We're going to do that. We're going to restrict the number of bottles people can get. But, you know, I was a schmuck. I didn't know anything about anything real in the wine business from a sales and marketing standpoint at that time. And I learned quickly that I was one of thousands of wine brands out there. I had some, you know, we can tell a story about the wine business and nobody else can in the U.S. And that's, we've been doing this for 167 years. We're the oldest winemaking family in the country. That's worth something. There's some equity in that. But it doesn't really get a wine sold per se. And, you know, what I found just kind of going back to what sales and marketing, the role that it plays in everything that anybody does, it's a difficult thing to do when you're trying to let people know about a book too. You know, it's easier sometimes to create the thing, to make a bottle of wine, to write a book, than it is to ultimately communicate about it, to get it out into the larger world. That requires a whole different set of skills and a different set of expectations. I'm a very optimistic person by nature, but I have been reality has been brought to bear to me many times over the course of the last several months since Lineage has been released, that for every person you know who knows you and knows you have written a book, there are literally tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people who don't know and whose lives are busy and who have considerations far removed from helping Stephen Mirisu with his writing career. So it's an ongoing effort to try to be true to the craft and the art of things while wearing the hat of commerce. And the same thing applies to the wine business.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah. That's for sure.
It's a challenge.
It is a challenge. And marketing is always a challenge. I can tell you that. one of the things I have to say, you know, I spent, as I mentioned, I went to England. I moved to England when I was very young. And I spent a great deal of time, actually, every other weekend would going to France. So I traveled a lot. I spent a lot of time, in an inordinate amount of time, in the Loire Valley. Because as a result, what happened is on our first trip, the first time my husband and I went to the Loire Valley, we discovered these caves. Now, at that point, we didn't know much about wine, but we discovered these caves where they gave you free samples. And my husband really appreciated those free samples. Now, as you know, driving along the Loire Valley, along the river, that road is not very big, the old road. And on one side, it's a big drop. And once he got the first free sample, so we went to the next cave and got another free sample and another. Well, after weaving around a little bit, and I decided, you know, it's a little dangerous, we pulled off in the forest, fell asleep, woke up, started the process again. So that was our first trip. So over the years,
sounds idyllic.
So tell us about, you know, people talk about wine and about, of course, we now know that California makes fantastic wines. Okay, so we don't have to worry about that. But tell us where you got, what inspired you from the Loire Valley.
Well, I mean, the first exposure I had really to Loire Valley wines was from a wine shop in Berkeley, Kermit Lynch, who has written an amazing book called Along the Wine Route. He's an importer, and he would travel to all over Europe meeting with winemakers who he was representing in the U.S. So he would meet these folks, taste their wines in their own caves, own cellars, and choose the ones he wanted to bring back to his wine shop. And he had written about a couple of his producers from the Loire, and in the Loire Valley, Cabernet Franc on the red side is predominant, at least in certain places. Chinon, Bourgogne, Sauvignon, de Champigny, these special little appellations that grow 100% Cab Franc. It's my favorite grape. It's the sexiest grape alive. It's the grape that I think manifests all the magic of wine the most clearly and in the most exciting fashion. So I was drawn to Cabernet Franc in versions that were mostly 100%. When you drink Bordeaux, they're blends. So Cab Franc plays a minor role on the left bank, a larger role on the right bank, but still not the star of the show. I always wanted to make versions of Cab Franc that were as pure as possible, and the Loire Valley represents that to me. It still does. So I'm going back to the early 2000s and tasting these wines from Kermit Lynch and falling in love with the purity of expression, of place, of time, meaning the vintage, of this very specific qualities of the grape itself. And when you do it in a version where you're letting fruit show through and you're not relying on barrels and stuff like that, you get the absolute sort of quintessential example of what Cabernet Franc is supposed to be. And that was the introduction for me to the Loire Valley. And we've had the opportunity in certain off years in California to make versions of Cabernet Franc that are reminiscent of that style. And we persist in our belief in Cabernet Franc as a grape and its potential role in the Livermore Valley as climate change continues to change conditions in the vineyards and will continue to make certain grapes more difficult to grow and ripen over time. So Cab Franc is playing an amazing and important role, not only in my own drinking and winemaking, but in the future of the Appalachian, it's the major place for me at this point in time.
Well, I agree. You know, we, over the years, we got to the point where we used to attend the Harrod's wine auction. So I'm familiar with it. And I think it's a wonderful choice. And as I said, I love seeing that photo of you. This, I think, and you've discovered, too, that marketing a book is as challenging as marketing wine. But I'm so happy that I've been able to help you with this because I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book. Perfect for, well, for all occasions. Wonderful at this time of the year. Perfect for as a gift. First, you want to buy one for yourself because it's just a great read. I mean, and I'm talking in the sense of almost like a novel. It's a great read. And then get it for your friends, and people will appreciate it. And on New Year's Eve, they'll be thinking about champagne, but they'll also be thinking about Stephen Kent's wonderful wines. How about that?
That's wonderful, Patsy. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you. It's been a joy. And I would love to be able to get the book out to as many people who have an interest in family history and wine and really just sort of the way I look at it, it's a love letter to people who work in the hospitality business.
Well, it's great. What is your website? Tell people your website.
So my website is my name, StephenKentMirisu.com. And there's links to buying the book. I also do a lot of other writing, so if people want to get other original writing, they can get it from my website. And we would love to be able to get books to people around the country.
Well, I agree, because it is a wonderful book. I wanted to just quickly mention this section where you are in the kitchen and you're writing about a family and the importance of getting together. And I just love this section where you're talking about, you know, peeling potatoes, going to make garlic mashed potatoes. Tell us just we have 1 minute to just tell us about that scene.
Thanksgiving's in my most favorite day of the year. And I love to cook, so I cook a lot during Thanksgiving. And the section of the book that talks about the family get-togethers that we've had at the winery over the years, excuse me, and just the simple joy of making potatoes or making gravy or whatever in anticipation of again, taking care of family, of having a chance to get around a table one time a year and live with each other and reconnect with each other. Food and wine have this amazing ability to help with that. And so that scene that you're talking about is sort of me describing my favorite day.
Well, it's a beautiful scene.
Thank you.
It's going to be part of a novel at some point. You have to you have to keep me in mind, because the minute you have a release date for your novel, which I know you're going to start working on now that you... That's a wonderful thing. I love that you use the word joy so much, and because the joy on paper of seeing your words, you've discovered it, and we're going to have a novel out of you, okay?
Thank you so much. I look forward to talking with you about it when it's ready.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Thank you, Patrick.
Bye. All right. Great. Let's go to commercials, and we'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back with my next guest, Sharon. Is she on? Okay, great. Sharon Draper, I am so happy to welcome you to the program because I really enjoyed the new book, which is called Out of My Heart, and of course, it is a sequel to your best selling book, Out of My Mind. How are you, Sharon?
I'm wonderful. I'm delighted to be here this morning.
Well, it's a thrill to have you because, you know, I love when an author finds a character that really takes over their mind and their life in so many ways. And in your case, when you wrote this, the first book, which, as I said, it was Out of My Mind, this was, now, how many years ago was that?
That was about 10 years ago, and I swore I would never write a sequel. And I got hundreds of requests from students and teachers, and, oh, tell me more, what should you do next? I said, I'm done. And then we had a pandemic. We had a year at home to sit and think, and I decided that this is the time to write the sequel.
Well, I'm glad you did, because Melody Brooks is very, it's one of those characters that once you read about her, you actually never forget. And I like when an author gets, sometimes you just get it right. You get the right name. So Melody is a word that you hear every once in a while. And if you ever think of somebody, know anybody named Melody, you immediately think of your book. Tell us about Melody. And I want you to tell us also, because in this day and age compared to 10 years ago, how do you describe somebody who has cerebral palsy? What do you say nowadays? What's the terminology? Because I myself always worry about what to say.
Yeah, when we were going through the edits for the book, we had to double check and triple check. And I called on people from across the internet. I said, read this section and tell me if I've said it right. Have I offended anybody? Have I worded this with the most current terminology that we use that is appropriate and not offensive? But still, you can't get rid of the fact that she is a little girl who lives in a wheelchair. And she can't walk and she can't talk. I named her Melody because it was a pretty name, and she needed something beautiful in her life. And so as the reader gets used to her and gets to know her, they can see into her mind, which is why Out of My Mind was the perfect title.
So is there a terminology we're supposed to use? Is there the proper word? I still don't know, you know?
She has cerebral palsy, which means she is disabled, differently abled, some people want to say.
Challenged?
But she's challenged, certainly. But when you take away all the adjectives, she's a brilliant little girl who can't walk and can't talk and frustrated because she's so smart.
So tell us, of course, this is a middle grade book, which is very popular among educators who often use it as a sort of a read aloud book. The children have really embraced it, which I find so heartwarming because we hear so much about bullying, and yet it is so wonderful to hear that children relate to this story and care about Melody.
I think that children are basically kind, and the rare cases of bullying happens in very small occasions. Most young people are nice. Young people are kind to each other. A lot of times when they approach someone in a wheelchair, they just don't know what to say or what to do. So I told them, if you see somebody in a wheelchair, just go up and say hello. You can't hurt anything. Give them a smile, say hello, say, I hope you have a nice day, even if they can't answer back. And a lot of young people have told me that they've done that, and it made a difference.
Exactly. That's all it takes. Just say something and be interested. And in this case, of course, tell us how in this new book, Melody's up to something. She wants to do something.
Yeah. Because she's limited and because she's stuck in this wheelchair, she says, I've got to do something different. I just cannot sit here all summer vacation on the front porch. So she finds a camp that caters to children with special needs. And she finds the camp. She does the research. She tells her mom, can I go? They've got an opening. Can I go? So Melody leaves all of the kids at school. She leaves the comfort and support of her mother and her father and Mrs. B from next door. And this is her own independent adventure. She doesn't know anybody when she gets there, which is kind of terrifying for any teenager.
Well, you know, you write about it so sensitively. And I think, tell us about what happens to her at camp.
When she gets to camp, they have a one-on-one division. So each child has their own counselor. And she meets her counselor, whose name is Trinity, and says, you're stuck with me for the whole week. And Trinity takes her in the pool. Trinity helps her in the woods. Trinity helps her with feeding and so forth. And but in addition, there are three other girls in the cabin, each with their own counselor, but each with their own individual special needs, just a little bit different from Melody. They're all the same age, but they have the same common experience, like parents hovering too much. One girl says, I keep checking that bush behind us because I'm sure my mother is back there looking. And so they need their independence and they need friendship. And for the first time in her life, Melody makes friends. And that made me really happy.
Oh, well, see, you're... It's so wonderful to hear the way that you talk about Melody, because to you, she's real, which is why you make it so real for us and why, you know, this book, well, the first book was on the New York Times bestselling list for 3 years.
Yes, it's off and on there. It's been there a lot.
A lot. Yes. This has been you know, so many exciting things have happened to you. When you were young, did you ever expect that not only would you be a New York Times best-selling author, but you would win the Coretta Scott King Award and all of the other awards? You won so many awards, the Charlotte Huck, and it must be pretty thrilling for you.
It is, and I had no idea. Actually, a lot of the awards, I didn't even know what they were, like, what is that? Ooh, is that good? Ooh. I write because I love it and because it's easy for me and I like telling stories. I was a teacher for 9 million years and I taught middle school and high school. And I know that many of the books that students are given at school, the ones that have been there since you and I were in elementary school, are still there. And they need fresh books with fresh outlooks on the way the world works today.
Well, you're right. And that's, I think, why you are so successful. And I think it must, you know, when you were young, very young, you've been writing, probably for a long time, right? Since you were little?
No, I started writing actually as a challenge from one of my students. Wow. The very worst student I had who said, I said, you don't have your homework. He said, I know, but here's a contest you ought to enter because you're a good writer. So I entered the contest and I won first prize. And it was from a challenge from a very worst student.
Wow, that is a beautiful story.
Yeah.
Because we just went through NaNoWriMo and many people were writing to me that, you know, they took part in it. And I've had quite a few who have written that it was also a challenge. My goddaughter challenged me to do NaNoWriMo a few years ago.
Yeah, that's a good way for a lot of people to start. But the way I started was just I won that contest, and then I took that chapter from that contest short story, which was very short, and I made that chapter one of a book, and it became successful. And so I had, that was Tears of a Tiger was the very first book, and then Forged by Fire, which combined that story that I wrote that won that contest. But I had no idea and no plans to be a writer. I was happy being a teacher.
Oh, and you must have been a good teacher. You're the kind of person who was a good teacher that you relate to the students.
Yeah, I loved my job.
Because I had a third grade teacher who tortured me, and I never had I never really had a great teacher when I was in grade school. I had one who tortured me. She made me, I'm left-handed, and she didn't want me to be left-handed. She made me sit on my left hand.
Oh, now, see, that's cruel.
Oh.
You can sue somebody for that these days.
These days, yeah. But in those days, you couldn't. All I could do is have my daddy walk me to school one day.
Yeah, and say, let her be left-handed because that's who she is.
Yeah, but it took me almost three months before I was brave enough to tell my dad. So that's why
That's a good plot for a story.
Yeah.
You know, the little girl who was afraid to tell that her teacher was making her use her other hand.
It was a thing with that woman. And so it actually turned me off of school very much when I was young because of that. So that's why when I hear you talk about, you know, your writing and then hear you talk about loving to teach, that's impressive.
Yeah, teaching was my joy. It really was. And I was teaching writing. So every day I was happy.
Well, that's the important thing. And now, of course, it's hard to go out there. And I'm sure before you used to go around and meet kids and do readings and have events.
Yeah, I miss that. I really miss that, traveling around the country. Hopefully by spring, we'll be able to start again and do some in-person visits at schools. But we have to stay safe.
Yeah, I know. But I believe that when you used to do those kind of events where you'd go with a group of children, at the end, they'd be just surrounding you and wanting just to get close to you.
Yeah, yeah. It was the most thrilling thing in the world to have a gym full of young people excited about books and reading. And I'd call them out of the audience and bring them down to the stage and we'd act out parts of the book. And it was fun.
Oh, that sounds glorious, because I had the experience of reading to little kids sometimes when I was teaching Sunday school, and just the joy that they would get and the thrill they would get. And then after, when you finish reading, they, you know, want to hug you. And it was so wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I do hope that it'll come back, because we really need to keep kids, you know, excited. And that's why I'm so glad that you came out with this. It's 10 years later, but you just got right into the character. I'm sure she never left you. She's always a part of you. And you've done a beautiful job with this book.
Thank you.
It's really lovely.
Yes, she's very special to me. And I have been talking to a lot of young people over Zoom, and, you know, they all have ideas for book three.
Well, I think it's, you know, and that a student would challenge you and that the teacher would take that challenge, I think, shows the remarkable type of person you are.
Well, it was that young man. I don't know what happened to him. I've lost contact with him. But if he's out there listening, I'd like to thank him.
Exactly. I hope he's okay, and I hope that maybe he'll hear about this story and get in contact with you, because he will be so proud of himself that, my goodness, he created somebody who gets the, you know, to say it that you got the Coretta Scott King Award is so wonderful.
Yeah. And he'd be very proud. He's students come back into my life all the time. Half of them are my friends on Facebook now. So,
oh, that's nice. That's wonderful. Well, I think you've done a beautiful job with this book. Is there a website you want people to go to?
SharonDraper.com.
And they can find out more there?
Yes, and all the books and anything they need, any information they need is right there.
And do you post your events, like when you're going to have a Zoom event?
Not always, because sometimes if a Zoom event is with a specific school in a specific school district, I can't post.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're getting a lot of them.
I post the things that are public. Yes.
Okay. Well, I think, as I said, I think it's so impressive what you've done, Sharon M. Draper. The name of the new book is Out of My Heart. It's a wonderful, it's a heartwarming book. And, of course, once you read this, you'll want to go back and read Out of My Mind, which, is, again, I'm sure this one is going to be a New York Times best-selling book. And the other one was just running. And, as you said, it sometimes still pops up as a best-selling. Probably after this, you know, it's going to happen again. So you have done a wonderful job for people to inspire them, to give them something to really think about and appreciate other human beings, appreciate what you have, and be happy that, you know, and that you have whatever you have. You know, there might be problems in your life, but if Melody can still have this enthusiasm and want to go to camp and want to do things, then you can do anything.
Yes. And I tell young people, if you see somebody and you're out at the store or whatever, and you see somebody in a wheelchair, say hello. You know, nobody speaks to them.
I know.
Say hello. I hurt my leg once, and I was in the airport, and I had to take a wheelchair back to the gate. And it was odd because nobody made eye contact with me the entire time I was riding in that wheelchair. Nobody.
I know.
But they looked the other direction.
It's wonderful advice.
Say hello.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, Sharon, it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. And I just, again, it's... Please, everybody, get this book. If you know any young people. Oh, and one of the wonderful things to do at this time of the year and any time of the year, if you don't have a child in your family or somebody, you know, in middle grade or any child, because this is a book is also great for teenagers. But if you don't have anyone, buy a book and send it to your local children's hospital or Shriners or St. Jude's, because they need books. The children in the hospital need books, and they're not allowed to share books anymore like they used to because of, you know, the germs and everything, this thing going around. So they need their own books. So if you can donate, you have just take a minute and donate to a children's hospital, both of Sharon Draper's books, all of Sharon Draper's books. Just go online, and all you have to do is send it directly to the hospital. You don't send it to yourself. Just get the hospital's address and send it directly, and they will be so appreciative.
That's a wonderful idea, and I'm going to do that this afternoon.
Okay.
I love that idea.
Yeah, they love it. They really do. And I was talking to somebody here at St. Jude's, and they are desperate for books. I donate a lot of books, you know, to different organizations, but they need books. So, and kids in the hospital really need books.
I'm going to do that.
Okay, great. Well,
wow,
you'll be
inspired me.
Okay, I'm glad. And as soon as you have a new book, you're going to come back. Okay.
I will.
Okay.
I will.
Keep writing. Bye bye now.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye bye.
Okay. Bye bye.
What a woman. What a, just, you, look at this. Somebody does something nice. Something, you know, I would love to know that this young man who challenged her to write. Isn't that a lovely story? So challenge somebody to write. Say, you know, write. My goddaughter, Kanisha, did it. She made me write a book, and I still have it. I unfortunately don't have time yet to edit it, but actually, I was looking at it at the beginning of NaNoWriMo. I had a look at it. I thought, you know, this is a heck of a good book. And it's over 50,000 words. And I did it not in, you know, normally in November you have 30 days, but I had to do it because I was having a very, very big Thanksgiving that year. And I had to do it. I had 25 days to write 50,000 words. And I wrote a little over 50,000 words in 25 days. And you know, it's not a bad book. If I actually take the time, find the time to edit it, yeah, it's a nice little book. And that's all you have to do. And it was a joy to do it. And Kanisha didn't do it this year because she's got a new baby. She's got a new baby. So she was a little bit busy. But, you know, that's what you have to do in life. Because remember, you know, this is what I'm always telling you. And, you know, when you hear somebody like Sharon Draper, the joy in her voice, or when you hear somebody like Stephen Kent Mirasu, you know, they've found this joy on paper. They are so happy with what they see. They see their words and they get so excited. And so anything I can do to help really people market their books and sell their books, I really am so thrilled. Go to my webpage, radio-joy on paper, and you have there the book buzzes done by Rita Moreau and by Devon Miller. Just listen to them, and it will give you an idea of the books that you will want to read, or that in the case of Devon, he recommends books for children, books that you want to buy and send to the children in your life, or perhaps to one of the children's hospitals. Okay, and that's radio-joy on paper, because you know, remember what I always tell you, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture or a streaming video or a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry, because her new series is fantastic. Be My Ghost is available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. Get it. It's a wonderful new series set right here in our area in Florida. It's a fantastic book, and it's called Be My Ghost. So you can get that, and then we're looking forward to the release date for the Jack Reacher series. Whoa, I'm so thrilled, and I'm waiting to hear about that. So everybody, just say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything you do. And everybody, take care. And he saluted me, and I saluted him, because I should have been a general. Bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage. I'm Steve Kathan. The road ahead is filled with uncertainty in tornado-torn Kentucky.
How do we even start? Where do we go from here? I'm trying to see into the future, and we don't even know where we're going to start.
Officials say it could be weeks for utilities to be restored.
There's no power lines, and there's no running water or gas, you know. There's not a whole lot you can do.
I'm Jim Krasul in Paducah, Kentucky. The biggest immediate need for thousands is housing, and officials are working to figure out what to do. President Joe Biden will visit tornado-ravaged western Kentucky tomorrow.
Pfizer says testing on its COVID treatment pill indicates it can cut hospitalization or death in high-risk unvaccinated adults by 89%. And the company says it is effective against the Omicron variant. In California, people looking for vaccine shots have had to confront the elements.
Chris Campbell and Tess Baker didn't count on an atmospheric river when they made appointments for vaccines, but they weren't about to let the storm keep them from getting boosted.
We're out here, so we might as well continue, and it's an important thing to do.
We're lucky to be able to get the booster. I think at the end of the day, a lot of people don't.
Demand for vaccines is once again surging in California, and the state has also reinstituted an indoor mask mandate due to concerns about the Omicron variant. Matt Bigler for CBS News, Oakland.
The big grocery chain Kroger says it's ending some benefits for unvaccinated workers, including pay for emergency leave, and it will impose a monthly $50 surcharge. In a world where everything seems to cost more thanks to inflation, CBS's Diane King Hall says there's the monthly rent to consider.
According to Move.org, average rent has increased more than 5.5% over the past year in the 75 most populated U.S. cities. 19 cities, largely on the West Coast, saw prices shoot up more than 10%. While 16 major cities saw rent decline.
Environmental correspondent Ben Tracy tells us an annual report on the Arctic indicates global warming trends are alarming and undeniable.
A United Nations agency confirms that during a heat wave last year, a new record high temperature was set in the Arctic of more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit. This happened in a town in Siberia, which is 71 miles north of the Arctic Circle. There is also alarming news on the opposite side of the world in Antarctica, where a massive ice shelf, including the so-called Doomsday Glacier, is rapidly thawing. Scientists say it could now become unhinged in the next 5 years.
Well, checking Wall Street right now, the Dow is down 189 points. NASDAQ is down 282. This is CBS News.
This hour's newscast is presented by Rocket Mortgage. Need to know what it takes for a home loan to fit your budget and your family? Rocket can. There's
now it's time for the Only in America Minute, sponsored by MyPillow. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Bill. Here's your host, Bill Cochran.
Well, he survived. The poor man, he just got here, they said. You know, he had jeans on, jacket, boots, and he was stowed away in the bottom of an airplane from Guatemala. Took a one-way trip to Miami. What a way to go. You know, can you imagine people coming into this country because it's the greatest country in the world and everybody wants to come here? And if they got to come in on an airplane from Guatemala in the bottom of the wheel well with their jeans on and their boots, hey, good. I'm glad. Glad he made it. Hey, America is the greatest country. So I guess I'd never want to leave it. But a lot of people should. That's all I can say. So why don't you think about it? In America.
Have you thought of investing money in the stock market? Well, get ready. We have a proven system that's successfully running for the past 6 years, helping our clients make winning trades with our artificial intelligence-based software. Call now to get in on our free live daily trading sessions as seats are limited. Call 727-597-4377 or visit us at www.sleepandtrade.com.
Futures trading involves risk. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future results. Go to sleepandtrade.com for our full disclosure.
The Republic of Pinellas every Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock on WTAN.